sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets rallying on oversold conditions. Oil surges because, well, it just did. Central banks are chiming in as the biggest week of earnings is about to be upon us. All this and much more on episode number 447 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, your host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And it is episode 447. We're in the final week of January 2016. We're seeing a tremendous amount of snow on the ground up in the Northeast. New York had about, I guess, close to 23 inches. And in New Jersey, there was similar levels recorded. Matter of fact, in New York, you probably know this, of course, the mass transit was shut down. All forms of transportation were shut down. And delivery services and all those people that didn't get their food in time, the Grubhubs of the world and things like that, were just shut down for a day or so in New York. Things seem to be getting back to normal now as the snowfall has subsided. And we are seeing that there's a lot of clearing going on. The bridges have been opened again between New Jersey, I guess Connecticut, and various tunnels and things of that nature throughout New York and the Northeast in particular. There was some flooding in New Jersey that was pretty ugly, but that seems to be subsiding as well. So it looks like things will be back to at least close to normal by the open of the markets on Monday morning. That's good news for many, of course. Probably going to be some schools closed still, I would think, but it's maybe not so good for some of the shoppers and the various stores that were looking for some revenue if the cold weather did finally come on, because a lot of the big box retailers have been complaining for some time that the weather has been a real problem. The warm weather in particular has been a real problem because people aren't buying certain things that are meant for winter wear. And they were hoping that the weather would turn a little bit colder and some of those winter garments and various shovels and snow blowers would be bought. But we didn't see that. And just as you would expect, the snow falls on probably one of the bigger days that you would have for people to go shopping, which would be on the weekend. Be better if it, even Terry Lundgren from Macy's commented last week that if there's a storm, he's hoping it's going to be on a Tuesday or Wednesday. That sets up really nicely for the next weekend because people will be out shopping looking for those various things that they didn't buy that they wanted to buy or they should have bought if the weather did turn colder. As luck would have it, storm hit over the weekend. Not sure how that's going to affect shopping, if it's going to actually hurt some of these places, or if longer term, if the weather does stay cold and it continues with the low temperatures, that there will be the shopping returning, the shoppers returning, and a benefit. We don't have a guest today. Actually, I called up Jim Grant, who I wanted to be on the show. We called him up over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And spoke to his assistants and asked for him to be a guest on the show. And we were going back and forth with calls. And they seem to have lost our emails. And I don't know. They kind of keep this guy behind guarded doors or something. I'm not sure what's going on. And we did not hear back from them. I'm not sure if there was a late email that came in. But we're just going to maybe get him in the future. Or maybe at this point with a lack of their organization and getting our emails and seemingly losing everything, we're not going to even bother. But oh well. But yeah, the cold snap did hit across the nation. Down here in Florida, it was 44 degrees on Sunday morning. And that's one of the reasons that people have been pointing that oil did rally. We saw that oil had just a massive move from about 27 up to about 32.19 on the close on Friday. And that was up 9% for the day and 9.5% for the week. That's pretty impressive. You got to admit that all the negativity that we've been seeing also with regard to oil, as oil has been falling, we've been seeing that there has been continuing calls for oil to go even further. Some have been saying that they expect oil to land somewhere with a one in front of the first digit, at least on the price, maybe $15, $18. So that gas prices are falling finally even more. I saw some $1.79 here in Florida. That was pretty shocking to see. I don't know how low it is in your area, but that was pretty cool. But oil did in fact surge, and this is on the heels of the information that Iran was putting another 500,000 barrels of oil on the market per day, possibly even up to a million a day, with the inventories overflowing and demand down and China's demand down and the concern that where are we going to put all of this oil and production at a multi-year or at least close to a multi-year high for U.S. drillers. And amazingly, we saw this big move, a lot of it on Friday, by the way. Now, we had options expiration on Friday, and we also had the cold weather coming in, the thought that maybe there would be some need for, you know, fuel and gas and oil to be used to heat, although it's heating oil. But again, there was this whole idea and the notion that, well, at least we have some cold weather, a change of things here, and that may be very beneficial to oil, at least the consumption of oil. I'm not sure how long this lasts with the fact that we still have a lot of negativity and a lot of sentiment to the negative side on oil. Or is this just the natural reaction to when we see that the sentiment has shifted so much to the negative side that there is just nowhere else for this thing to go? We see this so many times when you have that there are all of these sellers on any one position that any kind of news item at all that could possibly shift the trend, at least initially, turned. And then all of a sudden, you see a massive rally, which for any other cause, you would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. But now that we have everybody saying that oil should be much lower and there's going to be no sustainable rallies, really, I don't know anybody that's bullish on oil, unless you're an absolute contrarian out there and trying to take the other side for just no reason. But oil did fall pretty substantially the weeks prior to this and into actually this week. So maybe this is a point where we see that about $30, give or take a couple bucks, is the price that oil is going to really reach at this level. And we're going to see that they're going to be buyers stepping in and maybe even see that there is the potential for a bit of a turnaround. On the heels also of the chatter that there is possibly going to be some further central bank actions. We clearly saw that the ECB, Mario Draghi, had a conversation last week with the old, well, we're going to do everything we can, everything possible, and to make sure that Europe is saved and the fact that, of course, deflation is obliterated. Now, with that, maybe there was some benefit to oil on that, or maybe it was also because there was some murmurs that the Bank of Japan is going to be coming out with further stimulative actions as well. Of course, we can't put aside the fact that with many of the concerns we are seeing about the slowdown around the world that has been starting to leak into the United States, that it is quite possible that the Fed is back on the table in terms of not increasing rates for some time into the future, and even, I dare say it, the potential for further quantitative easing programs that will increase the overall bond position they have and the amount of buying that they are going to be a part of over the next couple of years. We already know that the next year we are going to see a massive increase in bond buying by the Fed due to the fact that there is a substantial amount of the bonds that will be rolling over. Now, let me put this in perspective for those of you who were not following me on this. What's happening? I thought the Fed was done, right? The Fed said that they are done with further new asset purchases of bonds, but they will continue to reinvest, in other words, buy any of the dividends and interest that come in, as well as any stock and any bonds that are maturing. They will take that money and they will actually buy more bonds with it. And because they bought a lot of short-term bonds back in the beginning, when they first started QE, a lot of those are starting to mature. A lot of them. And as they are going to mature, they will take those and buy bonds again to continue to maintain the level of their balance sheet with the amount of bonds that they have currently on the books. So what's going to happen here is that while they're not increasing their new asset purchases or their new purchases of bonds, what they're going to be doing is rolling them back over. And because there is such an extreme amount of bonds that are maturing, it kind of acts like new purchases, or at least an increase in the level that they're going to be purchasing compared to what they have been purchasing over, let's say, the last 6 months to a year. So while it's not a new quantitative easing program, what it is clearly almost the equivalent of additional purchases. While that doesn't mean that there is going to be a significant amount of liquidity or anything that is equivalent, you know, it looks to be a quantitative easing program, the fact still remains that it will keep interest rates down. Clearly, we did see that over the last week, the 10-year is under 2%, and it did move down considerably. And that could be either due to the fact that there is the idea that the Fed is going to back off, there is additional purchases that will be coming into play very soon, or the fear that with markets in such disarray and stocks moving lower so significantly, that there are many people who are saying, you know, the hell with this, my money is much better to be put into bonds. Why not? Anyway, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we saw over the last week and what's to come. And we'll get into a conversation about the oversold nature of the markets that we discussed last week on Frank Curzio's show. We did see that commensurate and probably due to the fact that the Fed raised rates in December, and the idea and the projection that, well, maybe the Fed is going to continue raising, at least that's what the thought was in the beginning of the month, the end of December into the beginning of month of December, end of December in the beginning of January, that there's going to be possibly 4 rate hikes throughout the year. It looks like it did get people off of the fence and deciding that, you know, maybe it's time to do something a little bit more quickly and a little bit more proactively with my home. We saw that the December jump in existing home sales was pretty astounding, a 14% move. And it's possible that some of this was due to the fact that there was delay in November transactions. We talked about this last month due to some new closing rules. But whatever you want to say about it, the fact was that existing sales rose dramatically and there was a real good level of home sales for the month. Now, also, we did see that there was some numbers that were related to inflation that came out. Now, we know that there's been obviously falling oil prices. We know that food costs factored in would probably bring down inflation. Rents also were a big issue here. But we saw that there was a headline CPI advance of 0.7%. But this was the smallest increase in the past 50 years for the full year of 2015. Headline CPI at 0.7%. In other words, inflation is very tame. And in fact, we did also see that the December number was only 0.1%. So there is a lack of inflation, really leaning towards the side of deflationary tendencies that we're seeing right now. Now, even though we saw that existing home sales improved dramatically, for whatever reason, we did also see that there was a 4% drop in building permits. Housing starts also declined about 2.5%, but they were up about 10.5% year over year. So there was some kind of good news, bad news. mixed in there. The look back numbers on some things were very poor. The look forward numbers on some other areas were very poor. And the reverse is true as well. We saw that some of the look back numbers when it comes to longer term trends with housing was pretty good, but yet inflation was pretty poor. And even so, with the thought that maybe inflation will start picking up, and maybe that's one of the reasons that the Fed was so absolute about finally raising in December, we're not seeing anything that really shows that there is a significant potential for any inflationary trends to really get out of control at all, and any of the numbers underlying the inflation statistics. So I'm not exactly sure. I'll give you this. It has become very clear to me, and it becomes clearer as time progresses, that the Fed, in my opinion, has a very poor ability to forecast anything even out into the next 2 or 3 months, much less the next 2 or 3 years. If you've ever looked at their forecasts and the amount of times they have to continually revise those forecasts, whether it's for GDP or inflation or for anything, employment, they're really poor at it. And that goes with pretty much everybody. It's very difficult due to all the inputs, whether it be the global economy, pricing, weather, consumer sentiment, and the list goes on of what possibly could change on a very quick basis that will throw off a forecast. So considering all of that, we have to realize that things change. Trend is probably one of the better things to look at, of course. But at the same time that you have to be able to bob and weave and to change your opinion quickly, because even as some of the best forecasters, or at least what's supposed to be the best forecasters, I mean, the Fed is supposed to be in a place that they know all the information, right? They're supposed to be the people that have all the information that everyone has, plus things that maybe some people don't have, to help them provide the forecast. And they're just really terrible at it. And if they're terrible at it, I can't imagine others that would be very good at it. So forecasting economics, and to a lesser degree, the longer term look for earnings and sales and revenues, very difficult proposition. Just keep that in mind. Something to realize that even though we get very excited about what the Fed says in a meeting, one coming this week, by the way, you've got to wonder, really how much we really have to abide by what they're saying to really believe and to invest in that as a condition for our investment thesis. That's a little beyond that. Not to mention that a lot of the analysts and the Fed have a bias towards being a little bit more positive and less in reality if things aren't good, and really trying to charge it up when things are good. This week, there's a lot coming. I got to tell you something. This is a big week for earnings. Big, with a capital B. We have Amgen, D.R. Horton, Halliburton, McDonald's on Monday. This is just a partial list, by the way. On Tuesday, we have the Consumer Confidence Index from the Conference Board, plus the November Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Earnings from 3M, Apple after the close, AT&T, Capital One, Coach, Corning, Freeport, MacBaran. We'll see what happens there. Who else do we have there? Oh, and Procter & Gamble, U.S. Steel. That's going to be interesting. We'll talk about what's going on in China on the steel area in a moment. We also have December new home sales. Federal Reserve policy statement is going to be on Wednesday. And we have earnings from Biogen, Boeing, Dolby Labs, Citrix, eBay, Facebook. It's going to be important. We also have Norfolk Southern. We're going to see what's going on in the rail area, PayPal, Qualcomm. They've been pretty miserable when it comes to their earnings recently on the Qualcomm side, and United Rentals. And on Thursday, we get data from on pending home sales and goods orders, initial claims numbers, earnings from Abbott, Alibaba, one of the most shorted Chinese stocks right now in terms of overall, and the short interest has been rising there. We see Altria and Amazon Caterpillar, Celgene, Eli Lilly, Ford, Harley Davidson, JetBlue, Microsoft. Big week. Very big week. Sherwin-Williams, Under Armour, which has been under pressure. Valero, Visa, Western Digital. And we're going to see the first estimate of quarterly GDP for the fourth quarter on Friday and the University of Michigan's final January Consumer Sentiment Index on earnings. On the earnings front, we'll see American Airlines, Chevron, Colgate, Palmolive, MasterCard, Praxair, Whirlpool, and Xerox. Now, year to date, we're seeing that the Dow is down about 7.5%, the NASDAQ 8.5%, the S&P down 6.7%. So we've gotten ourselves out of the hole of the worst January on record going back 50 or 60 years. We're only like the top, I guess right now we're in the top five at this level. So that's a big concern on a year-to-date basis. Listen to this. I mean, 1 year basis, the Dow is down 9.6%, the NASDAQ 3.35%, and the S&P down about 7.5%. 1 year change. So we're back below levels of a year ago. So there's a lot coming next week. I mean, a tremendous amount coming next week. As a matter of fact, I think it's the busiest week of the earnings season. So it's something that you have to watch, because we're going to watch not only, this is one thing that you have to really pay attention to. This is so important. It's really the overriding issue when it comes to markets in its entirety, is that earnings and earnings outlook are really what drives the market and market multiples. So we talked about how the S&P is looking like about 106 to maybe max about 110 for the fourth quarter final when you add up the full year. So the fiscal 2015, about 106 to 110. Estimates for next year are about 15 to 20% higher. Big question whether that's going to occur or not, and whether or not we're going to see the bounce back in energy earnings or not. And if we don't, you have to bring down those numbers substantially. So we're looking at possibly only, I don't know, maybe 110 to 115 next year. That being the case, we're not so far off at the current PE ratio that we will be if you target out and you see, okay, well, we have 110 times 17 or times 18, right? What is that number going to be? Well, about anywhere from maybe 1800 to 1950, give or take a couple of dollars on the S&P 500. So we're really at fair value at this point if all those numbers are going to hold. That's a big issue. Big question is, where do we go from here, right? That's the big question. And if we take the technicals and the fundamentals into play, well, we have to do a little multiplication. We have to look at what the earnings are going to be, what they have been, what the outlook is. That's why this week is so important. Big question is whether or not central banks will be the big trump, right? We did mention that Draghi was out with comments on all sorts of things and how he's going to do what he can. And last time he was out with comments, it did, in fact, take down the euro for about a day or two, and then things turned around. We do have a big speech on this week also. So there's a lot of things that are going on that's going to be interesting. One of the things that I did see, though, last week, and I had a conversation with Frank Curzio about this on his podcast. He brought up this topic of the CNN Fear Greed Index and what I thought of it, because it was reading about 8 on a scale from 0 to 100. Under 25 means that the big fear factor out there, a contrarian indicator. And we talked about this at about 11 o'clock in the morning last Wednesday when the markets were starting to hit towards their lows of the day, where they were collapsing. The Dow was down by about 500 points. And I wanted to play that for you because I want to talk about what this meant and how you can use this. So listen to this.
I wanted to talk to you about one of the technical things that I look at that works for me, and that's CNN, CNN Money's Fear and Greed Index. And I wrote about this before. Right now, it's at 8. Now, just let me explain this really quick, which I know you know, Andrew, but it's used to gauge the primary emotions that drive investors, and they take like 7 different factors: stock price momentum, stock price strength, stock price, the breadth of the market, put and call options, junk bond demand, market volatility, which is the VIX, and safe haven demand, which is the difference in returns between stocks versus bonds. So 7 things, and they punch it into one thing, and they come out with a number from 1 to 100. So, you know, when you look at a number and you can punch it up there, you know, a reading below 25 means extremely fearful, and it's a contrarian index. And so that means you should be buying stocks. Reading above 75 is extreme greedy. You should sell. Just wanted to explain that. Now, when I look at this index, it's at 8. Now, to put
that in
perspective,
that's a nothing. What does that mean?
That's extreme fear.
Well, it's a negative eight.
No, it goes from 0 to 100. That's what it goes from, 0 to 100.
Oh, 0 to 100. Okay,
0 to 100. So, you know, if it's the closer to zero is extreme fear, and then, you know, it's a contrarian indicator. It usually means stocks are really going to pop. And this, to put it in perspective, we were at 12 in September, right after that latest flash crash when the market fell 1,000. And from the end of September, like September 30th to October 30th, the S&P 500 popped 8%, 9%. Huge move. We're at 8 at a level that we were at during the credit crisis. That's how crazy, you know, based on this algorithm and this system, right, which I kind of like. But we're at 8, and that's where we were during the credit crisis. That's how scared mm-hmm. people are. So we're talking about all the negativity during this and, yeah, how everything is going down. But I wouldn't be surprised to see a huge pop because, I mean, this just – I would think a lot of the selling could be done and we could see a quick pop in this, maybe. And I don't know if you look at indicators that show that we're completely oversold here, right?
As a matter of fact, now that I'm looking, we have our own proprietary indicator that we have or that we wrote. It's available actually on TradeStation. It's called the KRI indicator, the key reversal indicator. It's at mm-hmm. right now, this exact moment, it's at a negative 6. I've never seen a negative 7, which is the most we can go to. But a negative 6, there's two components. First, it's a negative 6. That is the first issue. The second issue is that it is 7 sessions where it's been at a point of under 4 or 5, negative 4 or 5. So we're getting these cluster formations. This right now, combined with another indicator I have, I would agree to you with you that this is prime time for the potential for, it doesn't have to happen this moment, but the potential for a major reversal. The one thing that I wanted to see, you know, we're below the August lows and the VIX is only at 29. You know, back then it was like 40. And why isn't the fear index a lot higher? But I will tell you, I agree with you. And let's mark this right now. We're talking about S&P at 1835. Is that what it is?
Yeah. I mean, it's
1833. Yeah, 1833 on the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. I would say that about here, give or take, I just added a short VIX position just now to our mm-hmm. trading portfolios. And we just added a small cap position to the trading portfolios. And I would venture to say that those I would actually potentially even hold overnight, which we don't, you know, sometimes do with those, because we are seeing such an extreme reading on that particular indicator, which then ties out to the CNN fear greed. Now, that doesn't mean it can't stay that way for a lot longer, but I have not seen this kind of massive drop and cluster formations that we call it without a very significant turn. The one thing I'm going to look for is if we can close off of the bottoms and move up throughout the day, that could be a signal that we touch bottom and there could be a decent couple of day rally to relieve some of this selling pressure. Now, the reason that I bring this up is back to here, we're no longer listening to the clip anymore. The reason that I bring this up is I think it's really important to consider the fact that You need to have something in your arsenal, something that you're looking at that you can look to find areas that are going to be possibly levels that you're willing to buy or sell at. Now, the reason why you have to have something like this is because if you don't, you get mired and just locked into the idea that, well, the trend is one direction. It's always going to move that direction until maybe it gets over a certain level, and I'm not willing to take any risk at all until, you know, maybe we get over the 20-day moving average or whatever it is that you use. Or maybe if you're just staring at stochastics only, you may say, well, I want to make sure it gets into an uptrend again, and then I'm buying. Now, for example, when you look at Investor's Business Daily, they say that it's not safe, and it's not, by the way, to buy stocks when general markets are in a vicious or even a basic downtrend. And it makes sense because about 80 or 85% of all stocks will follow the very basic trend of the market. If the market's moving lower, generally stocks will move lower. There'll be some outliers there. But at the same time, you have to respect the fact that when selling is happening and maybe the selling is very pronounced and there's a reason for it that may go beyond just a one-day phenomena, you have to respect that and realize that even if you have a great stock, you may see a lot of leakage in the price due to the fact that maybe there's a revaluation happening in markets, or maybe the basket of the S&P, the NASDAQ, or the Russell 2000, Russell 3000, whatever index it is being sold. And if your stock is a part of that, what happens is it gets sold too. Very simple. The opposite is true as well. If there's a general trend to the upside and there's a lot of bullish activity going on, and if in fact there is a lot of buying going on, your stocks probably are going to move higher unless there is something that is changed. There may be some management issues along with the stock that are changing things. It could be earnings announcements. There'd be competition like we saw last week with Uber that is challenging Grubhub due to the fact that they're starting at-home food delivery. Whatever it may be, you have to realize that your stock will probably go along with it. Now, that being the case, you have to realize also that there are turning points where things get overdone to the upside or downside. So what Frank was talking about was an index that is put together that they call the fear-greed index that looks at when things are getting to a point of a contrarian move in the opposite direction. We have one that we built, and when things get to certain levels, we have the opportunity then to possibly move into, for example, shorting the VIX if we're seeing such a sharp downtrend where the VIX is popping real hard and all of a sudden there is a lull and we're seeing that there is the potential for a reversal over the next one or two sessions. Possibly go long an index, long add to a position of a stock, maybe even buy an option on the long side. And that's what we did actually on the lows of, or getting close to the lows. We started adding to the positions of areas that would see the greatest potential move to the upside, which would be small caps that were down about 3.5%, going on about 4% right before we hit those levels. And we did see, amazingly, it just worked out perfectly, by the way. And this is not necessarily, this conversation is not to say, oh, look how great we did. That's not the point. The point is to have something in your arsenal that will allow you to make those kind of decisions when things are either falling apart and there's nothing that looks like it could be done besides sit there and do nothing or even just sell out your whole portfolio, or at least help you make those decisions. Like, for example, if things are moving up too hard, that things are overdone to the upside and we're seeing such an extraordinary reading that would tell you, you know what, maybe I should take some off the table, at least for the time being. Maybe I should hedge out some of the risk like we talked about in our last episode. Maybe what I should do is possibly put an option on to protect some of my profits on some of the stocks that I own. So when you look at these kind of situations, don't just be thinking that there's nothing that you could do about it, because there are. And whether or not you use the CNN fear greed, whether you use something like the KRI index, whether you look at, for example, Tom McClelland's his work, and he shows that the McClelland oscillator was at a reading that was, even though he believes that markets will probably retest lows and we would see further downside, you just can't ignore the fact that, man, this is really an oversold condition, more so than just a simple, well, it's been 2 days that the market has been down, therefore it means it's oversold. We're talking about oversold levels that will take probably at least 1 to 3 days to at least, from a buying standpoint, get relief. And then possibly, if it is going to be the continuation of a downtrend, if that's what the market is doing and that is what it's up to, then you'll see it start to turn back lower and things get a lot worse. But every rally has to start with something, whether it's a short covering rally that we did see that many of the stocks that did pop were some of the ones that were hit the hardest. A lot of them had to do with the oil sector, of course, and we did see oil pop. So, you know, you did see that there was a big move on some of the worst plays, the things that have been just getting obliterated over the last 2 weeks. But we did see that even a Freeport, even though Frank and I talked about this one, Freeport from the bottom was up about 25% until it sold off again on Friday. But that's the kind of thing that you got to watch, right? When things get oversold to a point that is a level that is like, wow, you know, this is really, really a level that is just begging to be bought. Not just from a technical standpoint of maybe a moving average line or simply a trend or a previous low, but more so when you look at the sentiment. The sentiment got really bad last week. I mean, really bad. And this is on the heels of a very poor number. The GDP number from China came out at 6.8%. Expectations were for about 6.8%, and they came out right at 6.8%. So that's no surprise, because we know that China massages their numbers and does what they can to give us the best look at what's going on. But the fact remains that, you know, there was a lot of things going into the week that were really negative. And as they got more and more negative, people just pretty much threw the baby out with the bathwater. And then we found this level that was like, wow, look at this. There is a clear and at least a shot at taking a move to the long side here with an opportunity to, you know, have things pop, at least in the near term. So that was, again, just a lesson in kind of looking for other ways to find and see the market from a sentiment basis, not just technical, not just simply looking at the fundamentals, not just the news flow, but from a sentiment level. And oftentimes when you see it gets so negative or so positive, those are the times that are really opportunities to have a couple of day move to the other direction. And then usually what happens is usually you'll see the market start to move back down and test those levels or up and test those levels. Now, recently we've seen over the last, I guess, 2 years, these miraculous V formations take place. Big question is, will it happen this time? There's still a lot of real things that are causing some negativity with markets. But the question is, with this kind of move, with a lot of people on the short side protecting their portfolios, not in the market because they pulled out over the last 4 weeks or so, is this the start of the next rally or not? That's the question that you really have to ask. And for the time being, probably the things that you need to follow beyond the sentiment, which already has, from what we see, it's gotten back a lot of its negativity back to the positive side. At least it's worked off some of the negativity. The KRI indicator is somewhere about -1 right now. So in other words, from -6, and where's -5, -6 for a few days there, it's back to a -1. So it's not fully redeemed. It's not fully out of that. But you do find that a lot of the negativity and the stress has been relieved. But probably what you want to do, I mean, the simplest thing you can do right now is just follow oil. Markets are following oil. Equity markets are following oil because the concern of oil dropping down so significantly and then causing bankruptcies, stress on fixed income investments that are related to the bond portfolios of the oil companies and oil-related companies that then feed into banking profits and potential for not only distressed bonds, but potential for loan loss provisions that will have to be added back to the bank's balance sheets. In other words, they'll have to put some of their profits aside and set them aside for loan loss provisions in the event that any of these companies go bankrupt or can't pay the debt for a period of time. That's a big issue when it comes to markets right now. And oil, don't forget, is not just one country. It's not like, oh, well, it benefits Iran or it benefits Brazil or hurts Brazil. It's all over the world now. We have production in one way or another. So that's a big issue that you have to really think about right now. The second thing you have to think about, of course, is obviously China. Now, I have had several questions from listeners this week on China. Over the weekend, there was a very fascinating couple of different stories that related to this. Now, China came out with an announcement that they're cutting imports on steel in a big way. And they're also cutting their imports and their, I guess it would be called their storage or their stockpiling of other commodities. Now, this is on the heels of China's GDP coming in at the slowest pace in 25 years. 6.8% is the slowest pace in 25 years. And while many countries around the world, including the U.S., would say, wow, man, I wish we had 6.8%. That's really not so good when we really are not sure if it's down by maybe 5% or 6.5%, or it's going to slow down from this point, or it's going to stabilize. But bigger than that has been this whole issue of the concern about a devaluation of the yuan. Some are thinking that we have to see that the currency drops by another 50%. Let me just say that would be a big problem. Big problem for the rest of the world because it would just throw the whole currency baskets into just major disarray. And you have to look at you know, all the different factors of why that would be, because if in fact we need to see that China has a continuation of their currency devaluation because they need to make back some of the potential, one of the problems is they have about a 250% debt to GDP. And in order to extinguish their bonds and to drop the value of the debt they have outstanding, one way is to devalue their currency. And if they do that, okay, well, then they have a better debt to GDP, because what happens with bonds and the currency drop, essentially they're devaluing. But the other thing that that would do for them is to help create another benefit to their exports. Now, that would not be good for the rest of the world, because it would obviously shut down imports essentially to zero. Now, I got an email from a longtime listener from Wayne Stambler, and he wrote, he said, Andrew, Felix Zaloff believes that China will have to let its currency fall by about 20%, and they won't have the reserves to continue backing the currency. What do you think? Well, again, there's been a lot of speculation that the $500+ billion that was recently spent out of the reserves to defend the currency recently, due to the fact that there others are selling it and the currency is leaving the country, money is coming out of China, has been pretty significant in just all ways, whether it's money coming out of the stock market and being converted to U.S. dollars and out, and why there's been some currency controls that have been put into place. IDA Global is saying that should be, at least in their estimate, a 15 to 20% devaluation. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, 10% plus. I think that Goldman Sachs has also been saying that they don't want to see one, but they think there will be. There's already been some speculation that the People's Bank of China, which is their central bank, has already what it can, you know, what it can do this year, because they have the Chinese New Year coming up. And a massive amount of liquidity is always put into the system on the Chinese or before the Chinese New Year, so that banks can have enough money to provide liquidity that they need during that time of year for people taking money out and spending it, and all the other things that go on throughout the year, but more so during this period. This is February 8th that the Chinese New Year is starting. Their markets will be closed for a bit. And their markets will be closed due to the fact of the holiday, not because of the crazy things that are going on there. But probably it's fine with them that just for a little while, investors will have the time to cool off. We also have to wonder whether in anticipation of this, investors are going to continue to liquidate their positions in this market. They don't want to be in a situation, even if markets look good until then, that they want to be stuck inside of the Chinese market in the event there is some kind of a global situation that arises. So the thought that there will be an immediate devaluation in a big way, not just a small little tinkering that they do on a regular basis, I'm not quite sure that's going to happen right now, especially in the face that they are trying their best at the moment to ensure the currency stability in the face of the need for them to have stability ahead of this Chinese New Year and ahead of the liquidity requirements that they have. Like I said, they are already putting in some forms of capital controls very quietly into the background. They are obviously cutting down on their imports so they can maintain their reserves. But the big devaluation in the near term, I would say until after, well, the very short term, until after the Chinese New Year, I think is pretty much out of the question. And I think they're going to look to the People's Bank of China to maintain liquidity, try to instead hold the stock market up the best that they can in China. And at the same time, they're going to possibly look to maintain a high level of currency within the country. The last thing they need is a continuation of the yuan leaving the country at this time. So, I mean, I think that, you know, right now it's very apparent that they will do what they can to keep it strong, at least till after the Chinese New Year. Now, obviously, beyond that, though, what's going to end up happening is that, you know, with this conservation of cash they need and targeting further cuts in crude steel production and any kind of coal output that they have, this could be this whole supply side requirement to curb overcapacity and excess labor in state-owned industries. Now, what does that sound like to you? That sounds like they're having a cash crunch at the top level. Now, they've already lowered steel production by about 90 million tons in recent years, and will push to have about another, anywhere between 100 and 150 million tons of further cuts while controlling the capacity increase and halting new coal mine approvals. So again, this really sounds like they're trying their best to maintain and defend their currency and to make sure that they are cutting spending in any way possible in order not to have any problems with liquidity in the short term. So that's this recent revelation that's going on. And finally, I want to talk to you about my hair. Seriously. So I want to talk to you about I found a new barber. Now, the reason why I'm telling you this, and stick with me for a second on this. I moved recently about a year and a half ago, and I had a barber for years, a hairstylist, whatever you want to call it, when I lived out in the west part of Fort Lauderdale. They did an okay job. I didn't have a problem with what they did. I was pretty content with the way they cut my hair. Every once in a while, I didn't like it, then I liked it again. And, you know, even though I had the same person for years, I wasn't always just thrilled. So I moved to the east side of town, and I tried a new shop, and I thought, well, maybe they'll do a good job. I went to them a few times. I'm like, I don't like it. I went to another shop, and I found somebody, and then I went to another chair in that shop, and I liked a few of the hair. Then I'm like, you know, I really don't like this. I don't want to look anywhere else. I don't feel like I'm compelled to do so. So then, just the other day, I was driving around and was kind of looking. I said, well, there's a place I never saw before. And I stopped in, and, you know, finally, by golly, woohoo, my hair actually looks like I want it to look. Now, this may be a small issue, and this is silly, but let me just tell you, here's what the problem was. I looked at this for a second. I said, you know what? I guess the reason I didn't move is I was kind of lazy. And it wasn't so bad. It was okay. I didn't want to try anybody else. I didn't want to deal with it. So kind of, I thought about this and I'm like, well, you know what? Sometimes I think about that kind of what happens to many of us when it comes to our investments, right? You kind of get comfortable with something. And even though maybe it's producing right, it could be a stock or a fund or an ETF or it's doing its thing. I've had it for a long time. It's not terrible. It's not great. It's doing all right. But we get comfortable as an investor. And we get lazy. We don't want to move around. We don't know what else the opportunities are going to bring us, but we know at least what we have now. Right? Which is the greater devil? At least we know one versus the other. And we look at our investments and we kind of say sometimes that unless there's something crazy, well, we're not going to move on. We're not going to look for something else. We're not going to research it. But the question is it really meeting our needs, our objectives? Is it doing what we're supposed to be doing with it? Is it really the right thing? Is it the right place? Are we sticking with this just because we just don't have the time, the desire, the need, the want? Unless something big comes along, like, oh my God, there's a big manager change, or the fund just underperformed dramatically. And even then, sometimes we say, you know what? I know the fund, so I'm going to stick with it. I know the ETF. I know the stock. And I'm not sure what happens if I move anyway. So we just don't do the work. But I want to challenge you here to think about this and to consider the fact that maybe sometimes there is some opportunity and benefit and really an advantage to you looking around and saying, well, let me see what I have in my portfolio, and maybe there are alternatives. Maybe there are things that I should be looking at, maybe even in the same genre. So maybe you have the best way to look at this is really mutual funds, because stocks can differ, and there's a lot of reasons why you may want to hold a stock versus another. But a mutual fund and an ETF really are the two that you really have to focus in on if you have these in your portfolio, because you want to say to yourself, well, is this manager of this mutual fund that has been there for a while, performing up to his peers, and is it doing what I want it to do, and how is the fee structure, and how is the overall performance, and is it something that really I should have to begin with? Am I in the right particular genre of investment for me? Is it something that I bought many years ago when I was, let's say, 20 years younger, and my risk factor was X, and now my risk factor is Y, it's changed. It's either gotten more aggressive or more conservative, or maybe I haven't changed, but the fund has changed. Maybe something's different. Don't be lazy. Now, of course, change for the sake of change is not what we're discussing here, right? We're not talking about just changing because, oh, well, maybe there's some better flavor out there. And that flavor could be just a temporary situation. We're talking about a bigger issue. We're talking about making sure that you have what you need, and particularly when it comes to the fund. One of the things that we look at in our global allocation funds and our strategy is the fund actually not only performing to its level of its peers, but is the fund actually in and performing like the sector that we think it's supposed to be performing as? Now, here's a crazy example. We buy a mutual fund that is a, let's think of something crazy here. It's a mutual fund that is directly invested in the healthcare industry. Again, this hasn't happened, but I'm just throwing this out there. But we look and we start looking at the holdings, and it's all technology. But technology not necessarily related to healthcare, but just technology. Or maybe it's just utilities. I don't know, something crazy. Well, what happened there? How is it doing that? But again, it may not be that severe. But again, look at to make sure that there is no major drift of style when it comes to the fund. Because if you have a certain component of your portfolio that is supposed to be geared toward a specific allocation into a specific sector or style, and that fund that you have is not it, for whatever reason, that's a major penalty, right? That's something you need to kind of get beyond. So look at the idea that I brought to you about this whole laziness of me not changing barbers and me like just saying, okay, I'll just live with it right now, then realizing one day that, well, you know, something's right in front of me and maybe I'll take a look. Do that without having it right in front of you. Take a look at your underlying portfolio, particularly your mutual funds and your ETFs, and make sure those are the ones that you have. You don't have any stragglers just laying in there for whatever reason. Like, oh, I got this thing, it went down and never came back. I just let it sit there. Maybe that's something that should be changed. Be proactive in your portfolio. It's the beginning of the year. It's a good time as any to do it. If you can take some tax losses because maybe it hasn't performed over the years, okay, take the tax losses and look for something else that may be more beneficial or more appropriate in that particular sector that is representative of that particular sector a lot better off. Just some thoughts. Crazy way to get from the my hair to your investments, but there you go, okay? Anyway, we're going to end it right there. Hopefully you had some good insight into what's going on with oil and how oil tracks the markets and what's happening with China, as well as some of the things that are involved with making sure that you can find a way to understand a contrarian investment style in order to give yourself a great opportunity and to obviously get off of any one particular line of thought when it comes to investing. Next week, I'm sure we have, I don't know who we have lined up, but I know we do have a guest for next week. If you want to send me information on who you think is a good guest, a quality guest, you can always do so, or any questions that you may have at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com for the notes of this show. Of course, listen to DH Unplugged each and every week with myself and John C. Dvorak. And I will see you soon. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.